Hey there, and welcome to this video podcast, a joint production between Go Classics and Brown Car Guy. I'm Shehzad Sheikh, aka The Brown Car Guy, and as well as being a motoring journalist and content creator for 3 decades, in fact, plus 3 decades, I'm also the media editor and a columnist at Go Classics. And if you haven't seen it yet, issue 5 is currently available. It's still available. It's absolutely packed full of features, buying guides, tons of buying advice. And of course, it's got my column in it. You don't want to miss that. And I talk about the phenomenon of converting classic cars to electric. So don't miss that. Check it out. You can still get a copy. Head over to goclassics.co.uk now. You can get it in print or digital formats. You can read it straight away on your tablet, phone, whatever. Anyway, today I am joined by Go Classic columnist, another Go Classics columnist, and that's and he's also a podcast regular, in fact, is Simeon Cattle. Now, he's been working on cars since he was 16 years old. And as an apprentice, he also worked on classic Formula Racing and Can-Am cars, amongst others. Over the last decade, he's established his own workshop, the Classic Project Shop, where they've worked on hundreds of cars and have restored a load of classics too. But has he worked on any Ford Mustangs? We will find out very soon. But first, let's meet our very special guest for this episode, someone who's definitely worked on one or two or maybe a ton of Stangs. In fact, he's owned over 200 of them. Peter Cavallo of Classic American Car Sales, based over in Essex, has been in the UK since 2004. He's originally from New Jersey in the States and has quite simply lived and breathed Ford Mustangs since he was a kid, so pretty much all of his life, you know. And apparently, his parents always had to have a 1966 Mustang in the drive, and it had to be that particular year. Why? We'll ask him that question in a minute. From a very early age, he was inspired by his father to buy and sell classics, and a few years ago, he set up his outlet here, Classic American Car Sales, almost exclusively selling 1965 to 68 Ford Mustangs with the occasional Charger, Challenger, and Corvette thrown in. Welcome, Peter. How are you doing? How's 2022 been treating you so far?
Well, we're a month in, and it's going pretty good, and good to see you guys. Nice to meet you, Simeon, and ready to go.
So you sell Mustangs in the UK.
Yes, sir.
Why would you do such a thing?
I don't know. I just...
says the guy who's drinking his coffee out of a Mustang mug. Look at that.
I kept bringing cars in for myself, and then they would sell. And I would buy another, and then it would sell. And then I thought, hey, this is worth doing. So, we're about 200 Mustangs in, and still going strong, definitely.
So, Simeon, just to let you jump in first, say hello to everybody. How are you doing? How was your New Year's and Christmas for regular viewers?
Christmas was lovely. Walked away on the 23rd and got back for the 5th and basically turned the phone off, so everybody had a really good good rest. But it's phenomenally busy. We had a little bit of work booked in for the first couple of days, and I thought, well, I'll at least have a little bit of time to work out what we're going to do. But the amount of classic cars that require attention is just mind-blowing, so we're absolutely flat to the boards.
And winter is a busy period for you, isn't it? Because winter is pretty much when everybody sort of wants to get their classic cars sorted out in time for the season, which will begin from sort of spring onwards.
That's certainly what it is now. I mean, going back 10 years ago when we started the business, I think people were a lot more reactionary. They used to put their cars away for winter and then, start worrying about it mid-March, April, that sort of time. And then the season was quite a bit shorter. But we've had events here, local car events right over Christmas. I could have been on one on Christmas Eve and Boxing Day if I wanted to get divorced. There was also one on New Year's Day if I could have got out of bed. And just last Sunday, we welcomed 4,000 cars and 8,000 visitors to Bicester Heritage just down the road here. And it's the most phenomenal, January classic car meet I've been to. So many people, so many different cars, and it was amazing. So I think people are beginning to understand that if you prepare the car correctly, you can use it through the winter, but you've got to make sure it's properly prepared, and you've got to give it a really good clean when you get it back.
Sound amazing. I mean, I really do want to get up to the Bicester Scramble at some point, because that does sound like an incredible event. And Peter, you went over to the States over the winter, didn't you?
Yeah, my dad lives in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I go there about twice a year. And I just went over. I decompressed as Simeon did. My phone was on, but I just didn't do much car stuff. Usually it's every day searching for cars. When I was over in July, August, I bought 5. But this time I just wanted to spend time with my dad. And it was good.
Now, your dad is a real big inspiration to you. I mean, first of all, let's get into the whole 1966 Mustang thing. Why is it that? And then secondly, let's talk a little bit about how your dad sort of got you into this by, you know, basically buying classic cars with you all the time, whenever your mom was away, apparently.
Yeah, my dad was a bit of a crazy man. There was a couple of things he used to do. When my mom would go to Chicago to visit her sister, she would go for 3-4 weeks in the summer. And then as soon as she would pull away, my dad would go, right, let's get a car. And, you know, this was in the 80s when $500, $1,000, obviously we're in America, so it was dollars. You'd just go to the local car lot and you'd buy a Chevelle or nothing crazy, you know, but a Chevelle or a Mustang. He was into 59 Cadillacs. And you would just buy it. He had a friend who painted for like nothing. So he'd get it painted. I remember he had a 1960 Cadillac painted baby blue. And he'd drive it. We'd drive it for a couple of weeks. And one of the things he'd do is he'd say, let's see what she'll do. And he would go to Englishtown Road in Englishtown, New Jersey, and he would just bomb down the road like a crazy person in a car we knew nothing about. We should have had Simeon look at it because it probably could have killed us. And then he would sell it to a local kid before my mom came back, and we'd act like it never happened.
Did she ever find out?
Well, I have a story I really shouldn't tell.
Go on. It's only the three of us.
There was a catalog store kind of like Argus, which was called Sears. It was Sears. Yeah. And you'd go to the catalog store and you'd order stuff. So my mom used to love going there and ordering stuff. And then a week later, you'd go pick it up. So she came home early one time and caught us, you know, with the car. So my dad goes, you'll love it. So he took her and me out. And we went to the catalog store and she got out. She went in and it was winter. So we're sitting in the car, and it's me, my brother Danny, and my dad, and my mom's in the store, and he goes, there's ice over there in the parking lot. So my dad starts doing donuts in the parking lot. All of a sudden, my mom's out front screaming, and the manager of the store is going, you know, it's turned into the steer. And my dad's like, that idiot, you know. So that was a great story, you know.
But, oh, my God.
She would find out occasionally, but this continued, you know, up to the present day. He has a serious buying problem if he sees the classic. He's tried to buy some of mine and ship them back. And I said,
no
I just
way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Your dad sounds like an absolute legend. What's with the 1966 thing? Why did it always have to be a 66 car?
They loved, on a 66 Mustang coupe or convertible, there's a molding on the side that looks like that. It's 3 chrome fingers. And they just had to have that. And again, my dad would buy these cars for, my mom was involved in this. She liked the Mustangs as well. And he would buy these cars. And if it was a 65, they would just get the body guy to screw on the 66 emblem. So there's all these 65s driving around with 66 emblems that the owner's supposed to be like, who would do this? My dad. You know, they had to have that. They had to have that.
That's crazy. Yeah. So, Simeon, what about you? Have you worked on any Mustangs? What's your take on the Ford Mustang?
Early Mustangs. You know, I think they sort of lost their way between about 1968 and 2005, generally. But the early ones and this latest sort of two generations are fantastic. We see a couple of fastbacks in regularly. They're cars we've looked after for about 4 or 5 years. And I owned actually the worst notchback ever. Ever built, probably, which was a candy red six-cylinder auto that I bought out of auction probably about 15 years ago when I knew an awful lot less about Mustangs than I should have done, and just made all the mistakes that anybody could do. You know, the head gasket was gone. It was full of old number plates and road signs that had been sort of bodged together. It was slow. It didn't really make a good noise. The exhaust was hanging to bits, but it looked the business. And that really,
I was gonna say, yeah.
Yeah, that really, you know, it was candy red and it looked cool. And it was like $6,000 or something. You know, it wasn't particularly dear even at the time. And really, although it was a terrible, terrible, terrible car, I immediately fell in love with it, and I've had a couple of Mustangs since. But the best, my favourite, is a one that a customer's got now that I sold on, was a 289 fastback, Hurst four speed shifter on it, and all the cool bits. They're just fantastic to drive.
So this candy red Mustang that you had, did you daily drive that?
I would love to have tried, but it was lucky if it made it a couple of hundred yards before coughing all its guts up everywhere. So I spent a fortune on, well, I thought it was a fortune at the time, probably about the same amount of money again on sort of fixing it up, and then struggled out of it at $9,000. So, it wasn't a great money making
learning experience.
It's one of those.
So when was that again?
About 15, maybe 16 years ago.
So 15, 16 years ago, it was still possible to pick up a ropey Mustang for £6,000. That's incredible.
Yeah, easy.
Because that's just not going to happen today, is it?
No, it wouldn't. Well, no, it wouldn't. But, it was a six-cylinder auto notchback. So it certainly wasn't. If you take the sort of Holy Grail, you can tell me, but I guess it's a 289 fastback from that same era. They're always six, seven, eight times more money than a six cylinder notchback. So you can get all the look and none of the go for lots less money.
Peter, you talked about a little bit in the stuff that you sent me about an era when, you could drive along and you could find these things parked up at gas stations or petrol stations, as we know here, and it was possible to buy them and run them. And you mentioned particularly, when you could still find classic cars being used. Now, we all have this romantic idea living here in the UK of everybody in America driving Route 66 in classic American muscle cars. Is that not happening anymore then?
So the period I was talking about was in my 53. So when I was, in my teens and younger, the gas stations, before they became mini marts selling food and coffee and all that stuff, they were a gas station. They sold petrol and they had a garage. They would either have one or two garages and a mechanic or two working. So the mechanics were always guys in their 20s or 30s or 40s, and they were petrol heads. That's why they were mechanics. And they would have a Camaro, a Charger, a Mustang, a Corvair, an Opel GT or something alongside, and usually it had a for sale sign. And that was the primary place that my parents would buy cars. They would, I remember this place called Wilran Shell, and that was the name of it, W-I-L-R-A-N, Shell, guess. And there would be the mechanic and he'd have a car and they would buy it. And these were 500, 600, 700, maybe 1,000. They'd buy it and the guy would drag another one out and fix it when he wasn't working on customer cars. Even in Pennsylvania, that's a huge classic car area. You see on a Saturday and Sunday, you might see a dozen classics, but they're not going to the shop. You might go get a coffee, Cars and Coffee or something, but they're not in the supermarket car parks per se. But yeah, there are people driving them, not many daily drivers.
What do you think stops people from daily driving these cars? I mean, one of the things that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but especially my experience of growing up in the Middle East, and particularly Saudi Arabia, there's a huge American car culture in the GCC area. And, particularly in Saudi Arabia, because, Saudi Aramco, the Americans came in, found the oil, and then we all had Dodge Power Wagons, GMC Suburban, stuff like that. In my era, when I was growing up in the Caprice Classics, Buick Park Avenue, GMC Suburbans, they pretty much ruled the road,
Yes.
And the amazing thing about those cars was, and this is interesting, it'll be interesting to come back to you on the Simeon, that the perception here is about quality and all these issues. But in the Middle East, it was the reverse because, you could have little faults like the trim or the electrics or whatever. But the fact that the drivetrain was so robust on those cars, you could do hundreds of thousands of miles across the desert in very, the climate is tough on a vehicle over there, but you knew these things were dependable, so the perception that I've always had is that surely they should still be usable because, inherently they're tough vehicles, aren't they?
You're 100% correct. The Caprice that you mentioned, my grandfather was a Chevy salesman for, my whole life. taxi cabs, police cars, you know, you had the limit, you know, the LTD and all that. Those are, as you said, I mean, a Mustang, you can have it run, a V8 running on six cylinders. I just talked to someone the other day. He said he drag raced, road raced his car. He's FIA racing. And he felt he was down on power and he did an entire race. He came in seventh or eighth. He took the engine apart. The cam was broken in half. So you're 100% right. And I've had a lot of these cars. I've driven a lot of these cars. And I think I can count on one hand, knock on wood for the future, how many times I've broken down. And when I say broken down, it's usually ran out of gas. Yeah. You normally don't have a failure of a transmission or an engine blows up. You know, you can overheat it and let it cool down if you don't drive it for 10 more miles. You're 100% right. I think the people don't drive it. One thing I find is people restore a car, they spend 40, 50, 60, 70,000, and then they're afraid to drive it.
It's too precious.
I can't tell you how many cars I've bought like that. Immaculate. I have several in the shed. Immaculate cars that they've driven at 50, 100 miles. They're afraid to ding it. And I'm jealous of the guys that do daily drive them. There's
yeah.
In Malden, in Essex, he drives his white fastback every day to work. And I just see it go by and I go, that's the coolest dude I know.
Yeah.
You know? So what you said is 100% right. And you know, Simeon can make these cars as daily drivable as you want, as can I.
Simeon?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about American cars is that they were built to do big distances, and they were built for really different climates. So, you know, you've got states in America where it's 50 degrees centigrade, and you've got states in America when it's minus 25. So, you know, they're generally built a little bit on the lazy side in terms of how much power comes out of the engine, which is why they have big capacity engines. Which are really well engineered. So like Peter was saying, they can overheat and cool down and you can get going again without destroying a head gasket. Whereas if you do that on a little 1300 Austin, you know, head gasket's ruined and half your engine's got to come apart. And they have great big radiators in them. And, you know, just everything was slightly over-specced. So you very much can daily drive them. And like Peter was saying, you know, one of the reasons why it took so long for the V8s, the big American V8s, to sort of come out of endurance racing was because you could lose half a bank and still carry on. Whereas if you had a little four-cylinder turbocharged engine and, you know, something happened on one cylinder, then it's game over, you retire the car. So, you know, if you're running race cars on a shoestring, then you always use a bigger, lazier engine, whereas the guys that have got loads of budget will use a whiz banger because it doesn't matter if they destroy it, they'll just bring it in and slap a new engine in and away they go again. It comes down to the holy trinity of having fuel and air mixture right, cooling right, and electrics. And if all of those things are fine, then yeah, you can daily drive them. They're tough old beasts.
So, you know, you just reminded me, I love watching the classic racing at Goodwood, Festival Speed or the Revival.
Oh, yeah.
And then you see the old American cars and you see these big old things going around on, you know, literally cornering on their door handles, but they're just going at it lap after lap after lap. They just seem indestructible and super powerful. So, you know, and it put me in mind of what you were saying earlier about the cars being too precious. Is it almost the case that if you do want a daily driver car, you want something that maybe mechanically, drivetrain-wise, is fit, but not maybe the most perfectly presented car?
Yeah, a driver. It's funny, just going back to what we just said and what Simeon was bringing up, I have two cars that I bought, projects. You know, they look like you dragged them out of a junkyard, you know, parts missing, engines look like something from a Mel Gibson movie. And I was positive they wouldn't run. I mean, positive. And both of them, we got running in about 15 minutes. Didn't even change parts. Didn't even change spark plugs. Just messed with stuff, got the electrics running, dumped some fresh petrol down. And I was flummoxed. I just couldn't believe that these cars ran. And they would drive because the transmissions rarely give up the ghost. So, yeah, just amazing.
Simeon, what would you say is the perception, or the typical, not amongst our esteemed company and our sort of more aware company that we have here, but typically the impression that American cars have amongst UK buyers?
I think they think they're going to be really heavy on juice, first of all. And I think they also worry about parts supply. And both of those are such a misconception because, okay, a 66 Mustang's going to do 15 to 18 to the gallon, I guess. But you know, that's about it. But then, you know, if you drive a Mark II Jaguar, it does 15 to 18 to a gallon. So, you know, the in terms of fuel consumption, there's almost nothing in it, or an E-Type or anything like that. And the other thing is parts supply, honestly, is just the best thing in the world. We do a lot with, we do quite a lot of Chevy stuff. So we're always on the Eckler's website in the States. You know, it's a really good website. You can see all the bits. There's loads of photos, loads of exploded diagrams of it. You bash in the details, you know, you can have it literally in 48 hours ready to put in the car. So that's for anything slightly odd. But there are a couple of really good wholesalers here in the UK. US Automotive is one of them, and they hold an awful lot of stock for things like Peter's Mustangs and that sort of thing that you can get overnight. So actually, often you can get stuff from the States quicker than you can get a Rover P6 bit off somebody in, I don't know, you know, just down the road from you. Yeah, it's really good.
Now, going back to the fuel consumption thing, I'll tell you what, people often think, you know, big V8s are thirsty. But I remember I love V8s, you know, as you know, and I've driven them often. One of the things I miss most about living in the Middle East was driving the V8s. You know, petrol is cheaper there. But I did astound people because every time I used to run a long termer, I used to do economy runs on them. And I remember like doing some ridiculous economy figure on Chrysler 300 CSRT, driving it to Dubai, from Dubai to Abu Dhabi and back. And I posted up the figure and nobody would believe me. And I said, look, it's not about the engine. It's about how you drive it. Because a bigger engine can actually be made to be very efficient if you're not using all the revs. And you can be doing high speed and not using all the revs. It's just about how you nurse that car along.
Exactly.
You know, and coming back to you, Peter, just again, the same sort of question to you. What are the perceptions that you've had since you've operated in this market? You started selling cars here from, what was it, 2015, I think, was it?
2015, yeah, yeah. I just dabbled. I bought like seven vehicles. I went to the Charlotte Auto Fair in America, Charlotte, North Carolina, and bought seven vehicles and brought them back, and they sold. And then I bought seven more, and then they sold, and then I kind of went crazy. I left my job, my normal job, and just started doing this full time. The perception is normally people just smile. They mention that their granddad or their dad or where they used to live, they drove one. And what's amazing is how many people at the shows, I was recently at the NEC where I met you for the first time, and they go, I have one, and I have one, and I have one, and he has one, and I have three, and I met some gents who, they had like seven between them. So the history of American cars here is much bigger than I ever expected.
Yeah.
But yeah, they love them. I rarely meet anyone that, you know, turns their nose down at them. They all want to talk about it. I was getting my MOT in my Shelby once, and I heard a woman shouting, it's a Shelby, it's a Shelby, Shelby, it's a Shelby. And I turned around and she goes, my daughter's name is Shelby. And after the car, you know, and I let her sit in it and she took pictures. She goes, my husband's going to kill me because he'd love to be here. So it's in people, you know, they were never going to Maine or Kansas or whatever back in the 70s and driving these cars. And I get guys that show up to buy a car, and one guy was holding a Matchbox car, and he goes, this is what I want. And I was like, okay, a little strange, but we can do it, you know? So, people love it. They make people smile.
I'll tell you what, I can certainly relate to that. I mean, as you guys know, I test cars, I review different cars, but the cars that I get probably the most reaction with, last year I had a bullet spec Mustang, a brand new one, on test. And I never had so many conversations with people as I did with that car. You know, one time I had parked it, I came back, and a guy was just going, "Is this a bullet? Is this a bullet?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's a bullet." You know, another guy pulled up to me once. He goes, "I want to hear that rev." I'm like, you know, and most recently I had the Mach 1, the latest Mach 1 version, the okay. performance edition. And again, my neighbor was like, "Can I get pictures with the car and stuff like that?" I mean, and there's such an evocative thing about Mustangs, isn't there? I mean, I would say that Mustangs are probably the biggest movie cars that have ever existed. And I've got probably a couple of them here. And these are my own models. So as you can see, I've got Eleanor and I've got the Bullet Stang, the iconic. These are both icons, aren't they, really?
Beautiful.
Do you find that most people relate to these cars in this way, that they come back and, "Oh, I saw it in a movie when I was a kid," and that sort of thing?
I find so many people go, "I want the Bullet," or "I want the Eleanor." I would say every project I sell, that there's no other choice. They're not going, "I'm going to do it the original color." They're either building an Eleanor and a Bullet. I sell a lot of projects. I take mint show cars and I paint them Highland green. I just did it with a red 68. I pulled off all the Shelby stuff. It's going to be a Bullet. I do it all the time. It is absolutely the movie. You get people, they want the Charger from, is it Charger or Challenger from Vanishing Point? They want the Duke's Hazard. Yeah. They don't even say what it is. They go, I want that. I want I want the General Lee. And that's what I find. And I think that comes from what you guys saw, you know, in the movies. And when they found the first Bullet, I sold three in a week. And when they found the second Bullet, I've sold three in a week. And it just does not, I keep waiting for it to stop. You know, my wife says, "You're painting another one green." And my friends say, "You're painting another one green." I'll buy green. I wish every car I had was green. That's
how
it is.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Even the 65, 66s, which are not the Bullet car.
No, it's got to be the 68. It's got to be the 68 Fastback, isn't it? And you're exclusively doing Fastbacks now, aren't you, pretty much?
It's pretty much. I've got one coupe. But, yeah, if it's green, it sells. And I owe it all the Bullet. Thank you, Stephen Queen.
Simeon, do you find the same with your clientele, that a lot of them are inspired by pop culture, by what they saw on TV or in the movies?
Absolutely. You know, I had a customer just before Christmas and come in, and we were doing some work on his car. He said, "Oh, it's going for sale just in a couple of weeks." And he had been struggling. It was an Aston Martin V8, and it was a black and black manual right-hand drive, B-plate, Aston Martin. And he'd been struggling to sell it, had it up for 65-ish grand, which was very reasonable considering the, you know, what it was. It went to auction 2 days after the latest James Bond came out. And of course, James Bond ruins his DB5 in the first half of the film and then drives Timothy Dalton's V8. Car did £96,000 at auction 5 days after the Bond film came out.
And
we'd been trying to sell that car since June at 65k. Couldn't give it away. So, you know, the movies make the cars, there's no doubt about that. And even adverts, you know, we've had people come in and ask us for you know, a car that they've seen in an advert, or you know, on the funny antiques collecting thing on the BBC, and you know, "Oh, did you see last night's episode? They had this lovely little convertible on, and you know, do you think you could find one of those for us?" So yeah, movies, TVs, pop culture, long may it continue.
Absolutely. I think that's where it came from for me as well. Peter, we talked about, just Simeon mentioned the value of Aston Martins and how they can fluctuate. We saw 60s American cars a few years ago. I'd say about a decade ago, they really exploded, didn't they? The prices went crazy. Is that still the case with 60s American stuff now?
It has went mental. At the beginning of COVID, as we all did, we didn't know how bad it would be. Would there be, you know, 1,000 people dying, you know, a day, or 2,000 or 3,000 or 10,000? Was it a plague? We honestly didn't know. I don't think I'm overstating the case. I was scared out of my mind. I have, you know, elderly relatives, my dad and so forth. I had 33 cars at that time. I went through those like a hot knife through butter. And people were calling me up and just buying the car. And I really want you to come see it because I want happy customers. They're like, "Nope, I want it." And that was it. Prices are up for Mustang Fastback since COVID started 10 to 15,000.
Wow.
At least. Some of them are up 20. And every car that I sell now, I don't know how I'm going to replace it. That is how, I can't tell you. I'm paying crazy. I'm scared at what I'm paying for cars.
You know,
and I'm talking about cars that I sold a couple of years ago.
You know, it's interesting because I know that the market in general for new and used cars is gone crazy right now, but I'm not sure that that's what's happening with the classic market, because I think the classic market tends to be more insulated from normal market factors. But I think in your particular case, would you say it's a case of having people, you know, having the fact that we've all faced this uncertainty with COVID and basically faced our immortality, if you like, or our mortality, if you like, do you think we suddenly thought, a lot of people suddenly thought, you know what, if I'm ever going to do it, I'm going to do it now?
When David Bowie died, 2 days later, a customer called me up. He says, I want a fastback. I'm like, hi, my name's Peter. What's your name? And he's a lovely gentleman. He showed up, and the first thing he said is, my idol just died, and there's no pockets in your shrouds. I'm buying a car today. And he bought it, and he took it to Isle of Wight. He just bought it. Amazing. I just want to reflect on what you just said about the movie cars.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories is a guy came in, and him and his wife, and they were lovely folks, and they wanted a black Camaro. And they're telling me about this movie and telling me about this movie. And I had no idea. Please don't ask me the name, because I can't even remember. And they would show me clips from it and pictures that he did and little drawings of what he wanted. I had no idea what this movie was, but he was buying that car from the movie. And he was giving it specs and the color he wanted and the interior and the headlights changed to flip up and flip to the side and everything. We built the car. He was ecstatic. I still don't know what the movie was. the pull is strong.
Yeah.
With movie cars. But reflecting on the market, I cannot believe it. I'm actually worried about getting stock. I'm down to 14 cars from 33.
Wow.
And I've had turnover.
Wow.
And tried to buy stuff back. I cannot replace the cars.
I suppose one of the advantages you have is that being that you're specializing in the Mustang, it was the most popular, or in fact still is the most popular selling, you know, sports coupe in the world ever. So there should still be plenty of them out there, right?
There is plenty, but everyone thinks, you know, as we all know, everyone thinks their car is the best, you know, and you got guys, you know, with cars that are worth 40, 45, and they're asking 75. And I'm like, I said, I'm a whole, you know, I need to pay wholesale. I tell people I'm a dealer. I'm going to make money on your car. I'm going to fix it up, but I can't give you retail, and you're beyond retail. You're concourse retail.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have these arguments. I'm sure Simeon does when someone wants to change an engine in the car, and he might say, it would be better to get another car because you're going to change the engine and spend $4,000, $5,000, $10,000, but it needs body work and it needs paint and it needs floors and it needs interior. So sometimes the best decision is to just buy a better car. And I was told that by a friend of mine 30 years ago, and he's right. Buy the best you can afford.
And Simeon, have you also seen the same thing in your arena as well, that people are suddenly, there's been an uptake and people wanting to get into classic cars or fixing up what they've got, or, you know, it would value shooting up?
There certainly is. I think one of the things that COVID has done also, and it's not necessarily a great thing, is it's given people a lot of time to go online and read up. And they've sort of us guys are really good at this, by the way. We become experts overnight on things. I come back and tell my wife I'm an expert on all sorts of things because I've read it on the internet. And then they buy, you know, like Peter was saying, sight unseen, on auction sites. And it's not just eBay anymore. It's things like collecting cars. It's the market. Sight unseen purchases, go pick it up. They swallow the blurb that's either written by, you know, the original owner in most cases on auction sites, and they think they've got a fantastic deal because they've cut Peter out of it, the dealers, because they think they're expert at it, and actually. The process that Peter was talking about there, where he goes out, looks at cars, I don't know the stats, but I would guess he probably buys 10 to 15% of everything he sees. That's generally not because they're asking too much money for it, it's because they've got an underlying problem that will be too expensive to to deal with within the market cap of that car. So what happens to it is it goes to an auction site, or it goes to an auction where you either can't look at the car, or you're under immense pressure to make a decision in a really short period of time. Now, that's the mistake I made. You know, I've been in the motor trade since I was basically 16 years old. So even 15 years ago, I should have known better. But hey, I'm a guy. I saw a cool looking Mustang and it was at an auction, and I had some money burning in my pockets and I went and spent it. You know, and then you repent at your own leisure, really. So yeah, we've seen that COVID has really pushed the market along. It's a bull market, not just for Mustangs, but for just about anything right now. Again, cars I was looking at selling maybe a year and a half ago, probably worth 15 to 25% more than they were now, right now, and they're selling fast. They're not just sitting around. So, you know, my honest advice is pay a dealer's premium, because if you find somebody like Peter who really knows their cars, they've made loads of mistakes. I'm sure if you look at Peter's books as well, they'll be cars he's made money on.
Have you seen my history?
You know, so
to a great go on, deal, Peter. Reveal all, Peter. What was your biggest mistake?
Well, a quick one. It was a recent auction. You saw the car. I'm sure you did. It was a gold fastback, and I looked at it. And I needed stock, and it looked great. And I went very well known auction house, and I snuck in because you had to buy a brochure, to get in. I snuck in, and I looked at the car. It was covered in blisters. Not just micro blisters, blisters. That car needs a bare shell takedown and repaint. You're not going to scuff that and paint that. So that's $10,000. I looked underneath it. There was like tape around the exhaust. The exhaust was comically bad. And it was described as a beautiful, a lot of money spent car. Someone is, as Simeon said, they buy it and someone bought it and paid big money for it. And they have at least $15,000 to spend. My biggest mistake, I had a car that was described to me as a show car, and it was up on the lift at my mechanics, and I kept looking at the floor, and I know what the floor should look like, and I'm looking at it, I'm like, Scott, it just didn't look right around the edges, and I'm like, but there's no rust, the transmission tunnel didn't have any cuts, and I'm just looking at it, and then I pushed on it, and it lifted up. So to cut the long story short, it was a used floor they had cut out of a car and glued it in with mastic. The floor was just sitting in the car. You could push the entire, the guy who fixed it and put a full one piece original style floor in it, he said, I didn't have to cut anything. I pushed the floor out. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I get cars inspected and then they show up and we have to replace quarters and drop offs and frame rails. And we do it. Real quick one. This is going to make you laugh. My dad bought three cars. He's a crazy person. Years and years ago at an auto museum place, a very famous place in Chicago. He bought three cars. The first one came off the carrier and there was rings of rust on the floor, like divots of rust that had fallen out just on transport. So that was a 69 Mach 1 that needed the bottom 10 inches replaced. But he had a pickup truck, and he ended up selling it to me for really cheap. It was a beautiful Chevy pickup truck, power steering, power brakes, automatic, air, 60s, 68, 67. And I was under it one day, and the underneath was beautiful, and I'm looking at it. It's all black, very light undercoating, and there was a bit of orange or yellow. And I touched it. The frame rail was spray foam. They had spray foamed the frame rail and carefully trimmed it, sanded it, and painted it black. It was a death trap. Yeah, I sold it for $5,000. With full disclosure. But I had like 18, 19,000 in it.
Oh my God. Oh my God. So that's, again, there's some real horror stories there, alerting people to not buy sight unseen and go to an expert. Coming back to I think we've learned that lesson. So coming back to cars themselves and coming back to values and looking beyond Mustangs as well, American cars, like I said, in the 60s cars, you know, the values shot up a few years ago, and they're still going up, as you've already said. We've seen that with some of the 80s cars now, haven't we? We've seen that with the Bandit Trans Ams and stuff like that, where they've really gone crazy. Is that now beginning to happen with 90s cars and stuff? So, for example, the Camaro IROC Z28s and the Knight Rider Trans Ams?
Grand Nationals, the ZR1 Corvettes, absolutely. I mean, every era, you know, we look back to the 60s and the 70s. Guys now that are in their, you know, 30s and 40s making maybe $100,000 working for a bank, they're looking at when they were a kid in the 80s and the 90s. You know, the Buick Regal Grand National is a great example, and the GNX and the Corvettes, the early Corvettes. Absolutely. The performance cars of the era. It's always going to be popular. I don't know what folks in 10 years are going to hark back to.
Yeah.
Remember the batteries in that Prius?
Yeah. I don't know. But even things like, so for example, I remember I wasn't a huge fan of these, but the Fox Body Mustangs, you know those ones, right?
And I was
never a fan at the time, but apparently now they're changing for big money.
I wanted one since I was 14 years old. And I bought one about 4 years ago. It was a police edition.
Oh, wow.
SSP, had all the history. And I had to buy it. I wanted it. I've always wanted a notchback 505 speed. And I had to buy it. I had to fulfill that dream. And I did. So, yeah.
How was it?
It was horrible. I drove it about 25 yards and decided I was a fool. It was very stock. It needed proper seats. The rear diff changed from a 279.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful, beautiful car. A lot of fun. My wife never wanted to drive it because it had all the police lights and sirens and speakers on it, and she refused to drive it. I was at a show once, and my wife was with me, and she was like, don't use the speaker or the siren. And then someone said, you know, would you mind driving it around the ring in the center?
Yeah.
And my wife just put her head in her hands. So we're driving around the ring in the center, and someone goes, "Use the siren!" And my she like went onto the dashboard, so I clicked on everything. So it was a fun car. $10,000.
Yeah.
But that car now would be $25,000.
Wow. So
we're maybe talking 5 years ago.
So what are hot tips right now? We've obviously we've established that Mustangs are unburstable, but what are hot tips right now when it comes to American cars? What should you be getting into, which you can still just about afford?
Two-door, V8. And the performance edition. I always say, you know, if you can't afford the performance edition, buy the six-cylinder. They're tons of fun. Get the V8, get the performance edition, because the same as property, the standout car will always be in demand. You know, if there's 10 IROC Zs, I want the 5.7 liter. You know, I don't want the 302. I want the 5.7, the 350. So when you see a car, the big thing at the shows is people look in, oh, it's a 4-speed or oh, it's a 5-speed. I'm not saying the automatic is not desirable, but get the thing that's a little different. The best color, the 2-door rather than the 4-door, the V8, the performance model, the manual.
So what if you were to buy one, an American car at the moment, what sort of budget are you looking at? So for those people that are maybe just on the edge thinking about it, and they're like, well, I may have enough money, but I'm not sure. Can I buy it? Can I afford to run it? Can I afford to maintain it? Can I afford to insure it? You know, in a sort of ballpark figure, what sort of budget are people looking at?
I would say £20,000 should buy you a nice car. Not a fastback, not the most incredible model, but you'll get a V8, probably 15, you know, in a non-Mustang, you know, a Caprice or a Nova or something like that. 20 to 25 will get you a nice base model. It won't have the insane rims and all the disc brakes and the crazy 396 or 454 V8 or the hypo. But, you know, the Mustangs are now in the 70s, you know, for the hot model and the best color and shiny and new. As far as maintenance, I'll leave that to Simeon. But, you know, an oil change once a year, a checkover by a competent shop such as Simeon's. And you really, you know, you don't have to do these crazy, you know, full fluid changes and engine out services. Oil filter every couple of years, brake fluid and transmission fluid, and get it looked over. Change your brake cylinders if it needed. Preventive maintenance is much cheaper than fixing it after it goes wrong. And Simi will be your expert on that.
Simeon?
Yeah, I mean, I always say with any collector's car, you've got to have a budget of £1,000 a year tucked away, because you often, especially if you've just bought it off Peter or something and it's been fully serviced and it's all, you probably won't spend that grand in the first year. You might not even spend it in the second year, but in the third year, you're going to do maybe some tyres and, or, you know, brake cylinders or a new caliper or something like that, and that'll about work out. So I always say, you know, as a minimum, if you buy a really good and together car, £1,000 a year. If you buy something that's a bit more of a rolling project, then you've got that grand to spend a year, and you've probably got another two to slowly bring it up to standard. Mechanically, obviously, if you go and do paint work or interior retrim, you can blow $5,000-$10,000 at a time doing those sorts of things. But yeah, that's about the size of it. Insurance is cheap. Somebody like Hegarty or any of the specialists all run American policies. Usually a couple of hundred quid a year max, really. And what was the other cost you?
No, that was it. The running, the maintenance, and the insurance costs. So that's the interesting thing. So as we come into a close on this amazing session that we've had talking about American cars, I think a final word from each of you, basically to encourage people who may be thinking of pursuing that dream but are just maybe hesitating, why they should do it, why they should do it now, and what does it take to actually do it? Peter, we'll go with you first.
I suggest doing it now because, you know, I think it's going to become harder and harder to locate these cars. I'm struggling, and I have contacts everywhere in this country and in America. I've bought cars from Canada. You know, the prices are going up. You know, past performance is not indicative of future performance. I'm not the trader that goes, this car will definitely go up in value. But in my experience, since 2015, they've went crazy. I hope that continues. But I think the smiles it brings, the enjoyment, and I tell a little story that was told to me. When you're looking at these cars, and you drive them once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month. And when I have someone indecisive about, let's say, two Mustangs, they're looking at a convertible and a fastback or two different color fastbacks, and they go, Peter, tell me what to do. And I tell them this story. And I say, okay, you work in London, you live in Essex, it's winter, it's dark until 8 o'clock, it's dark at 4:30, okay? You get up in the morning, your wife's sleeping, your kids are sleeping, the dog's snoozing, you're heading to the train in the rain and it's dark. You're not gonna see them, the kids will be sleeping when you get home and your wife will be grumpy because she's done all the housework. What do you wanna lift the garage door up just to look at before you take that train into London to slog your guts out? What blows your dress up? And that's what I tell people. And I actually get a chill, and I just did every time I say it, because I go in the garage. I don't drive my cars a lot because I don't have time. My green 68 Fastback blows my dress up. And that's why I own it, because it makes me happy.
Simeon?
Yeah, I mean, wise words. Always buy what's going to blow your dress up. And buy the best you can at the time. So if you put those two things together with the preventative maintenance, you will have a good relationship with your old car, whether it's American or not. In terms of why you should buy an American car over a British car or French or German or whatever else, why do we all love going to McDonald's when there are other cuisines out there? They're just great. You know, they're not pretending to be anything more than they are. But you know, a Big Mac's always welcome. And driving around in a Mustang just makes everyone smile, you and whoever you drive past. So really, you're doing a public service.
I love it. That's a brilliant. That is a brilliant point to end on. That not only are you are making your dreams come true, you are enjoying yourself, but you're doing a public service. And actually, I can relate to that. I think it's absolutely true. Talking of which, I definitely have to go and buy a lottery ticket because I've got to do this soon. Honestly, I've wasted way too much time as well. I've got to do this. You have certainly, both of you, inspired me to try and do this and to try and get something like this. And I hope that we've inspired the people that have been listening and watching to this as well. Thank you once again so much, Simeon, for joining us. And Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure and an absolute delight to have you on board. Thank you so much. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Take care.
So just before we go, Simeon first and then Peter, give your businesses a shout out. Let people know where they can find you and how they can find you.
Okay, so we're Project Shop. We are a general service and maintenance garage for all classic cars, American or not. Everything, you can see them up behind me, from a Volkswagen Beetle to an Aston Martin, anything in between. We're based in Bicester, just near Bicester Heritage. And you can find us at projectshop.co.uk.
How you doing, guys? I am classicamericancarsales.co.uk. I search out, import, and repair classic Mustangs from 65 to 68 with an emphasis on fastbacks. And I also sell projects. I sell driver quality cars and I sell show cars. And we can do any level of what you need to them. We can get them painted or fix whatever you want or sell it just the way it is. Happy to talk to you, and we're located near Colchester in Essex.
A big shout out and thanks to Jay Williams over at AirTechnic, who are my top tier sponsors. Check them out at airtechnic.co.uk for exhaust, brakes, suspension and body kits. Plus my other major sponsor, Riverhall. Much appreciation also to my tier 4 sponsors, Muhammad Ali Hamid and Tom Conway Gordon. And of course, all of these other guys who are supporting me on Patreon. I am eternally grateful, because without you, I can't be creating all this content. Hey, think about joining them. Head over to patreon.com/browncarguy. If you can't, don't worry. Just make sure you subscribe to my YouTube channel and my website, plus follow me on all social media channels by searching for hashtag Brown Car Guy.